Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, surrounded by Israel's massive security wall, will the Comboni sisters on the Mount of Olives be able to open their kindergarten doors again this year? A look at the special bond between Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul II, and prospects for a Vatican-sponsored conference as it kicks off in Korea.
One day, sisters woke up in the morning and they found that the trees of the garden were all cut because they had decided that the wall would have such a line which follow the line they wanted, and we have to say that this wall really has changed our life there.
Spanish-born sister Alicia Vacas recalls the grim day in 2004 that the Catholic convent she shares with 11 other Comboni sisters on the southern slope of the Mount of Olives became yet another casualty of the ongoing tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli soldiers appropriated convent property and began constructing what is today a section of Israel's towering 26-foot-high security wall, cutting off this part of Bethany overlooking Jerusalem from the West Bank. It was here, the place of Lazarus, as Al-Aizariya is known in Arabic, that the Gospel of John tells us Jesus rose Lazarus from the dead. The Comboni sisters have lived there since before Israel became a state. Well, I visited the sisters' convent in January 2010. The wall cuts right through the convent property and takes up two sides of a tiny playground for the kindergarten that the nuns run for some 50 Palestinian children.
It means that the families of the kids of the kindergarten, they remain all on the other side. And the village of Al-Aizariya, the village of Bethany, is on the other side. The church is on the other side.
Is that the church where you go to Mass?
Yeah, this is our church. And this is our parish, let us say. In Jerusalem, there is only one parish. So this church is not, juridically, it's not a parish, but it is the church we go every week. And this is the Christian community we follow. And the families we know, we visit, and everything now is the other side of the wall. And the other way of reaching out is going to the checkpoint, which is 15 kilometers far from home.
And how long could that take you?
Well, if you go by car, it could be like half an hour, because you have to make 15 kilometers after the checkpoint and then come back. And if you go with public means, it is more than 1 hour, because you have to go to Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem you have to take another bus going all around the through the checkpoint to basically to the other side of the wall. It is like it could be 20 meters far from home. The church is not more than 50 meters far from home. But you have to go through Jerusalem and then through the checkpoint, and it takes more than 1 hour. If there are no problems in the checkpoints, because sometimes you get stuck at the checkpoint, sometimes if there are Jewish feast days, for instance, checkpoints are closed. If the situation, the political situation, is unstable or is risky, checkpoints are closed, so there are so many limitations.
Sister Alethea and the other sisters are cut off from their church, and once familiar Christian processions on feasts like Palm Sunday can no longer take place. Those on the wrong side of the wall no longer have access to hospitals, schools, shops, and businesses.
It is a fact that occupation prevents religious people to reach the places of prayer for both Muslim and Christians. Palestinians from the West Bank, they cannot reach the temples or the places for prayer. Christians cannot go to the Holy Sepulchre to pray, even on feast days, like the procession you were talking about, and Muslims cannot go to Al-Aqsa in their feast days. And especially during the feast days, the roads are closed. They are not allowed to go. So it's a difficult situation for all of them. Mm-hmm. And many of them have lost their jobs because they cannot get to Jerusalem to work. And a place like Al-Aizariya, Bethany, was mainly depending on Jerusalem. because it is so close. It was so easy for them. Most of them work on tourism or selling things to pilgrims. And so more than 60% of the families in El Aizarilla lost their jobs because of the wall. What has been the solution for them? For many years, they have been jumping the wall. And at the beginning of the construction of the wall, our garden was literally occupied by people who were trying to find their ways to cross the garden and reach Jerusalem. When the wall became 8 meters tall, it was impossible. But till now, there are people who keep, young people, especially men, who keep jumping the wall to reach Jerusalem to work. And then they remain in Jerusalem like 1 week or so, and they go back home with the money.
I remember you telling me that one night you had a knock on the door of somebody who had tried to jump the wall and had broken his leg or something.
Yeah, he fractured the knee. And it happens every day. We can hear them, and sometimes we try to help them with when they fell down. Sometimes they get cut with the wall, the fences, they get
the barbed wire.
Yeah, yeah. So it's also a difficult situation because we have to see the soldiers running after them, and sometimes they are hunting them in our garden, which is not nice at all. Sometimes soldiers are asking us to intervene and not to allow them to jump, and we have to say that we are not there as guardians. That it makes us it puts us in a difficult situation, and as much as we try that soldiers do not get into the garden of the house, we don't want the house to be
a military
zone. Camp.
Sure, sure.
And we don't know it to be known as the place where they are hunted.
Or whatever.
Mm-hmm. But it still is difficult to handle.
The sisters have painted brightly colored giraffes, lions, and tigers to soften the impact of the wall on the 3 to 4 year old toddlers in their care. But I wonder how successful that effort is. The solid cement structure casts a deep shadow over the little playhouse, slide, and games. Thanks to Vatican intervention, Israeli authorities opened a small window in the wall, allowing the children to return to school in 2009.
The kindergarten was closed 1 week, 1 whole week, because there was no way of passing through, of getting through. The wall was high and closed, and then the only solution that the army gave us is sending the children through the checkpoint. But it was difficult, impossible. Taking a bus and making the children go around more than 20 kilometers, 15 going, 15 coming back. Also, we have to say that most of the families are very poor there, and they are already supported with the school fees, so they don't have the chance of getting a bus and paying transportation for so small, so young kids every day. So the situation became very complicated, and the intervention of the Vatican ambassador, the nuncio, was a blessing for us, and he managed, I don't know how, but he managed to convince the army to open space for the kids. They promised the gate, and the gate became sort of window. I mean, it's so high, it starts more than 1.60 meters high.
meters is 5.25 feet off the ground. When I visited, it was in time to see the nuns in their white habits take the tiny hands of these toddlers and lead them two at a time up a steep flight of metal steps to reach the open window. They were so careful with their tiny charges, not one must trip or fall, too far to drop. The scene before me was surreal, to say the least, and I was suddenly overwhelmed by an immense, an inexplicable sense of grief, the kind you feel when someone very dear to you dies. But for Sister Alicia, that staircase was a blessing.
It took a long time since they put it. So the first days we were literally lifting the kids and passing through the window.
And there's a huge drop on the other side.
Yeah. And we were using bricks, for instance, or anything just to make it a bit higher and helping
goodness.
The kids through.
And you've got the soldiers there with their machine guns. Do the kids think about that situation?
Well, at the beginning it was traumatic. Also because most of the kids, they have a very very difficult background and ideas on soldiers. So the first day we had the terrible experience of one child, for instance, crying and shouting he wanted the dad. And of course, families cannot pass through this as a small window. So we cannot have a real contact with the families now because they cannot come to visit us. They cannot come to take the children if they are sick. They cannot come for the feast on Mother's Day. So this child was crying. He wanted the father, daddy, daddy. So sister told him, you know, I called your father. He's coming. Just to calm him down. And he started screaming more and more. And he said, no, soldiers are here. They will shoot at him. They will shoot at him. You know, they have this impression. They are very young kids and their image of soldiers is a very aggressive one because of their experience on checkpoints and television. And we try to make things smoother somehow. And some of the soldiers are actually very nice. And some of them are even Arab Israelis. And one of them is a Christian Arab Israeli. And some of them are very kind with the kids, and now it's much the relationship between the children and the soldiers are nice and smooth. But it is a traumatic situation in any case, and it is so ridiculous. I mean, if you see the kids jumping through the window and waiting for hours, sometimes the soldiers forget to come and open because this window is open 15 minutes at 8 o'clock in the morning and 15 minutes at midday. So quite often they just forget or they are late, they have other business and they come 1 hour later. So having the kids there under the window waiting for them to come is so ridiculous. So it doesn't make any sense. What kind of protection are they trying to take from children? I mean, what kind of security threat are them?
Apparently, Israeli military deems the security threat too real. The kindergarten is due to reopen September 16th, but since I spoke with Sister Alethea, the window in the wall has disappeared, and it is unclear whether the school will resume with no opening in the wall. The Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem is reporting that negotiations are underway to find a solution, or there will be no school this year. Sister Alethea Vacas is one of the Comboni missionary sisters in Bethany, East Jerusalem. She wasn't called to die for her faith, but she passed away in 1997, a true servant to the faith. Mother Teresa of Calcutta was known the world over for her selfless and enduring care of India's sick, dying, and of the poorest of the poor. Her missionaries of charity are now found in some 130 countries around the globe. The order counts 450 brothers and 5,000 sisters worldwide, and operates 600 missions, schools, and shelters. Emer McCarthy tells us a little more about her.
If you receive a little child in my name, you receive me.
Born in Albania, August 26, 1910, for over 45 years, Mother Teresa ministered to the poor, sick, orphaned, and dying, while guiding the missionaries of charity's expansion, first throughout India, and then throughout the world. She is revered by believers and non-believers for her charity work, her commitment to interreligious dialogue, and to her enduring pursuit of peace. In her lifetime, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, the Order of Merit, and honorary degrees from the world's most prestigious universities and academies. But before all else, Mother loved and lived her Catholic faith.
Jesus said, whatever you do to the least, you did it to me.
In a message to the Superior General of the Missionaries of Charity, marking the 100th anniversary of Mother Teresa's birth, Pope Benedict XVI described her as an invaluable gift for the Church and the world, and encouraged the Order's sisters to imitate her good work and spirituality.
In October 2003, it was his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, who beatified Mother Teresa in a big outdoor celebration in St. Peter's Square. Just 2 years after her death in 1997, responding to what people here called an avalanche of requests and testimonials, the pontiff had dispensed with the 5-year waiting period to begin her cause for sainthood. Photographs of Pope John Paul and Mother Teresa over the years speak of a special bond between them, the tiny nun dwarfed by the towering Pope. John Paul called her an extraordinary example of charity and contemplation.
Esempio straordinario di questa silenziosa missione di carità che nasce dalla costante contemplazione di Gesù sulla croce è Madre Teresa di Calcutta.
Mother Teresa herself likened Pope John Paul to a father in the church.
The church, the bride of Christ, the church, our mother. We can glorify God through the church, in the church, and with the church. By our fidelity to the gift that the Church has entrusted to us. The gift of acceptance of us, of our hands to serve and our hearts to love. We must not spoil the Church by our selfishness and sinfulness, for we all together make the body of Christ, the Church. And at present, our Holy Father is a real Father to each one of us. If you all have that fidelity, the strength of faith that he is trying to give to each one of us, will help us, that fidelity to love the church and to serve the church with a pure heart.
Father Leo Masburg is a diocesan priest from Vienna, Austria, who knew Mother Teresa well and accompanied her on many of her missions outside of India. He also collaborates with the Vatican Commission investigating her cause for sainthood. I talked to him about Pope John Paul's involvement in the cause.
I believe it was Paul VI already who said, nowadays we don't need so much teachers than teachers who are witnesses. The world of today is overfed with information, but the kind of information which a witness gives is a different kind. And I believe that our world is very sensitive to witnesses, to ideals, to personalities which open with their lives and with their actions the way to boundaries beyond the beyond. And I must say Mother Teresa was one of them, because she never only gave you a teaching, she always gave you the example. She was the first to touch the poor, to smile at them, to bear them, to forgive, to be patient. And even to be patient with yourself. And when you feel her forgiveness or your goodness, when you feel it yourself, it's much easier to imitate. And I think that's my reading of the Holy Father's mind.
Now, the cause for the beatification of Mother Teresa is unusual in the sense that Pope John Paul waived the mandatory 5-year waiting period that follows a candidate's death. Was there any sense of urgency in the Pope's actions there?
Well, isn't it more an urgency in the world needing such a well-known testimony? She was very well-known already through her lifetime, so it would have almost been like a break if she had fallen in oblivion. And so by accelerating the course, I feel that he made her from a living saint to a saint living on.
Mm.
And maybe that's a possible explanation or reason for that. Apart from that, he certainly was convinced himself that she was a saint. Because if I remember properly, he already said, almost mistakenly, the big saints of our time, like St. Francis and Mother Teresa. So he was, in his heart, he was convinced that she was a big saint. And so he wanted to, respecting the church's rules and customs, he wanted to have her proclaimed a saint. Yes, Mother Teresa was certainly the missionary of our century and of our millennium, maybe. I believe that she was a millennium saint in the line of St. Francis, St. Benedict, and so on.
So many people, you've often seen pictures of Pope John Paul and Mother Teresa together. What do you see of the two that unites them in some way?
Well, I see that God created each one and creates each one of us in a completely different and individual way. And there could be hardly more different people than the Holy Father and Mother Teresa. And still, two things united them very strongly. The first, they loved each other very much. By love I mean they respected each other. They knew each other very well. They knew, Mother Teresa knew very well what the Holy Father was and what a Holy Father is. So she was full of respect. She accepted his authority like a child. And she would not do anything which fell in his competence without asking him. So, for example, she would not have gone to Russia if the Holy Father had not given her permission. And she asked, sometimes she asked down to the smallest details, because she retained it important to have his blessing and his permission. And the Holy Father, on the other hand, for sure knew exactly whom he had with Mother Teresa. He knew that she was a religious. He knew what a religious was, what a foundress was. And I think he saw much more and more immediate who Mother Teresa was, the greatness of her sanctity. He recognized that immediately. And that's the one side. The second side is that they both looked into the same direction. They both want to bring Christ to the world. And that united them so strongly that these gestures, when you see the Holy Father holding Mother Teresa's cheeks or putting his arm around her, they just show the unity in their mission. In their mission, each one in his individual mission, but completely united in the love of God.
And a warm thanks there to Father Leo Masberg, friend and pastor to Mother Teresa. Well, as we heard earlier, the missionaries of charity that Mother Teresa established today have homes and institutions for lepers, AIDS victims, the sick, and homeless all over the globe. They even have a home here in the Vatican. We went down the street to speak to Missionary of Charity Sister Agnes Marie, who tells us how it came about that the sisters first opened their doors in the Vatican.
The desire to establish our community came about in Calcutta when John Paul II went to visit Mother Teresa and our congregation in 1986. It is there, while visiting one of the houses for the poor and dying destitute, that Pope expressed his desire to have the poor in the Vatican, to which Mother responded, "I will do it." 2 years later, we were allowed to begin our mission in the Vatican according to the desire of the Pope. Here in the Vatican, we run a home for the homeless women. Many of them are mentally disturbed. At present, there are about 30 of them. They come mostly from Europe, but also from Africa and Asia. Our community have 7 sisters, and we come from India, Kenya, Ukraine, and Poland. We run also a soup kitchen for the homeless men. I mean those who live on the street. They come in the evening for a supper, and they go back on the street. In all what we do, we are being supported by many volunteers from all over the world, but especially from Italy. for which we are very grateful. For Mother Teresa and for us, her sisters, was very important the way we live and approach our work of charity. This is why it is so important for us to practice our loving trust to Christ, total surrender to God, and cheerfulness. Mother used to say that we never know how much and what a simple smile can do. It is not important how much we do, but how much love we put in what we do. What is helping us to live it out is the fourth vow that Mother joined to the three evangelical councils. And the fourth vow is wholehearted and free service to the poorest of the poor.
Sister Agnes Marie of the Missionaries of Charity here in the Vatican.
So bring prayer, joy, love, and peace in your family, and you will be able to grow in holiness. Holiness is not a luxury of the few. It's a simple duty. God bless you all.
Proclaiming Jesus Christ in Asia today is the focal point of an international congress opening in the Korean capital, Seoul, Wednesday, sponsored by the Vatican's Council for the Laity and the Korean Bishops' Conference. Well, Council President Cardinal Stanislaw Rilko will preside an inaugural Mass in Seoul Cathedral, launching 5 days of seminars and workshops on the life of the laity in the mission of the Church in Asia. Ahead of his departure, Cardinal Rilko spoke to us about the challenges of the Church in Asia, which he hopes to see tackled at this Congress. Susie Hodges has more.
Those challenges, he said, include a growing fundamentalism that imposes drastic restrictions on religious freedom in many Asian countries, where there are cases of discrimination or outright religious persecution. The Cardinal goes on to add that the bishops of some Asian countries denounce the sad phenomenon of a bleeding of the Christian presence, whereby many Catholics leave their countries at risk and flee to safer places. In this sense, the Christians of this continent need our solidarity and our special spiritual support.
Altra sfida è costituita dall'incontro con le grandi tradizioni religiose asiatiche.
Cardinal Rilko points out that another challenge is the encounter with the great Asian religious traditions. This encounter creates the risk and danger of the spread of a mentality of relativism and syncretism that distorts the real meaning of evangelization. The Cardinal says this results in a tendency to replace mission with a vague dialogue in which all positions are equal, reducing evangelization to a form of human development. Asia, the Cardinal concludes, is rapidly changing. The last Congress of this nature was held 16 years ago, and since then the effects of globalization on the continent's rapidly developing economies and societies is notable, particularly an emerging post-modern mentality that rejects God. All these challenges, he says, show an urgent need for a serious Christian formation, a thorough initiation of the baptized, whether in parishes or in lay associations. I'm Susie Hodges.
And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.